Welcome to the Successful Athletes Podcast presented by Trainer Road, where we interview successful athletes to make you a faster cyclist. Today, we're joined by John Peter. And John Peter, are you out of Wisconsin? Is that correct? Or Minnesota?
Northern Minnesota.
Northern Minnesota. So you're close to the border up there.
Kind of, yeah. We're about an hour from Fargo, North Dakota, and a couple hours from Canada. So
yeah, check it out. That's cool. Yeah, I should have specified there, the border of South Dakota. So it's you reached out to come on this podcast. And it was actually after hearing Taylor Ledeen's podcast that kind of gave you that extra spur to come on. And today I want to talk, we're going to talk about your athletic endeavors for sure, but we're also going to spend time talking about the intersection of mental health again and endurance sports, specifically in this case, bipolar disorder, and the almost mirror-like in some aspects relationship that it has with endurance sport. I'm really looking forward to the conversation. But before we go any further, let's get into your background. So you are, and people can actually, we'll link to this. There's a video down below that, which JP or John Peter in this case is a coach of a soccer team and coaches this awesome soccer team. And there's a documentary actually on YouTube about it, which is awesome. So you can check that out. But prior to that, you did cross country and track. Did you do that at a collegiate level? And how long were you running? And was that your main focus?
Yeah, for sure. It was my main focus through high school. And then I did run in college. People hear that you ran in college and they're like, oh, awesome. And I always tell people, like, my times would have been really good if I were a woman. But they were, average, below average for a guy. But it didn't discount the experience. I was a 5,000, 10,000 meter guy on the track, and then I ran cross country and I loved it. And then continued after college to kind of run because I loved it and was a little bit addicted to it maybe. And then also just, it was something to do and to stay healthy, and I like being skinny. So, it was a great thing to do, you know?
How much did you run in a typical week in terms of whether it's distance or time?
Yeah. In both college and then post-collegiately, I was probably running between 60 and 90 miles a week on a regular basis, and kind of depended on where I was in the training cycle, if I had a big race coming up or not. But that was kind of the range I was always in. And, if we think about like how many days a week was I doing, I was definitely in that idea of that I had gotten into in college of like, I don't need a day off. A day off is like an easy 5 mile run, or a day off would be, we're going to run Sunday morning. This is what we did in college a lot. We're going to run Sunday morning and get our long run in, and then we're not going to run again until Monday late afternoon. And there's like 24 hours in there, right? And that's a day off. And so, and I look back now and I laugh, but I think as athletes, we do that a lot, and we bend the rules to get more in. And we always think that we're doing ourselves a favor. And days off didn't exist when I was running.
Yeah. Logically, to the endurance athlete, more is just better, right?
No, for sure.
But there is certainly a point of like diminishing returns. Now college athletes famously get away with really, really high amounts of training volume, horrendous rest and recovery, bad nutrition, all these other things, and you can kind of just get away with it. What sort of focus did you put on rest and recovery as a runner?
Yeah, I still slept enough, in the range that you should. And we would, and especially in college, we would sneak naps in because it was just easy to do. But nutrition, don't like garbage barge, right? It was terrible. I think the famous line out of the book, Once a Runner, is like the furnace always burns hot. And it'll burn everything, and so you would be eating these terrible meals. And even post-collegiately, I didn't really start eating vegetables till I was in my late 20s. And I read Racing Weight by Matt Fitzgerald. Yeah. And that was, he was an author who really started to say, we got to actually look at nutrition and what we're eating. And so slowly started introducing like one vegetable a month or, one fruit a month until I was eating a pretty balanced diet. And I've been doing that ever since. And I look back and I'm like, how much better could I have been had I eaten healthy food? And just all the stuff that goes with that. So,
yeah. Right. there's this strange thing that when we're young, we don't like vegetables very much. And that does change over time, and we all kick ourselves for it. So you mentioned your post-collegiate times. What pushed you into cycling and away from running?
Yeah, when I was around 2010, I was getting ready for my first marathon. And in my build up to that, I partially tore my plantar fascia in my left foot.
Ooh.
And super painful injury. Yeah. And when it healed, it didn't heal correctly. It healed like as a fibroma, which is like a ball of tissue, basically. Oh. And also very uncomfortable and inflexible, basically. And I was told, like, we can cut this out, but chances are these tend to grow back if you cut them out. And they said, you can run it like zone one or two the rest of your life, or you can find something else to do. And I'd been watching the tour a lot. You know, like, I'm one of those people. And so let's go ride bike, and kind of got into road racing, but fairly quickly got into gravel racing. And, when I had been in college as a runner, my coach always told me, we don't have a distance long enough for you, for how you're wired. You know, I could run at zone three forever in those workouts and never get tired. But if we went up into the higher areas, man, I struggled. And so I got into gravel racing, and it was this long attritional style racing. And I was like, this is my jam. This is the greatest thing. And I loved it, and found some success fairly early in it, and just kept at it, and really enjoyed racing gravel.
What sort of distance did you focus on? Like you said, almost like a new lease on your athletic life, going from 10K.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, which 10Ks, what was your best 10K time?
Actually? Well, it was like 34, 30, somewhere in there, 35 minutes, right around there. Not fast.
Crazy
fast. For a man, for a woman, it would be incredible. But, you know, for a collegiate runner, it was pretty average, you know, and especially
I guarantee
it's a bigger
the vast. The vast majority of everybody listening is blown away thinking of, like, first of all, like a sub 18 minute 5K is crazy fast, let alone doing even below that pace for 10. So that's really fast, but you're still doing something you're specializing in something that's around 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So what sort of distance did you pick with gravel? Did you just instantly go into big old, like, I don't know if you did Unbound back in its early days anything else like that?
I jumped right into a 100-mile race. And the very first one I did, it was like 95 degrees, which is incredibly warm for here. And so, like, had all kinds of cramping and hydration and nutrition issues that I didn't know about. But yeah, pretty much raced like 100 milers and Unbound always lined up over, I'm the track coach here at our school, and it always lines up over like the end of the season. So it just never works to get to. But you know, there's a lot of gravel races all over the country, and especially in the Midwest area. And there was always stuff to go do, and find races about that length. And I really enjoyed that 5-6 hour time frame.
Yeah. And I'm sure you learned so much with, like you mentioned, on the nutrition and hydration side. You're also an extremely analytical person, if I'm not incorrect there.
Yeah.
You like to bring data together to be able to, you know, have broad observations and then be able to apply that data set to, like, your coach with the athletes that you serve. How did you start to tackle all of this? Like, did that tickle the nerd nerve of being able to power data and everything else that you suddenly had?
Yeah, you can just say I'm a nerd. It's okay. I'm not offended by that.
Me too.
But yeah, it depended on where I was at. You know, at that time I didn't have a power meter, so everything was off a heart rate and perceived effort. And you know, for those of you that think you have to have a power meter, I trained for 3 or 4 years without one. And got super fit,
yeah. You know?
But really worked on the nutrition piece. And the nutrition piece is always different depending on where you are. Like, your race might be different on what it offers you or what it doesn't offer you. And if you got to do something fully self-supported, you got to plan it totally differently. And like you guys talk a lot about, you got to figure out how much carbs can I take in and not get sick. And all those pieces, and you know, if you don't have a big budget to do it, you know, joking about, I spend more money on fuel for myself during a ride than I do on my car. you know, I've heard you guys say that, and I can relate to that. And figuring out, you know, as a as a dad with five kids and a wife who stays at home, the limited income we have, I can't go out and buy Marton every time I want to get fuel. So I got to figure out how to do it myself or something different that is going to give me just as much food source. But yeah, it was very analytical on that end. And then also finding race courses, you know, looking at race courses ahead of time and then figuring out, thankfully where I live, it's very rolling hills. You can get a lot of elevation quickly, even though there's no mountains around. And looking at courses and figuring out around us, where's a similar course that I can go simulate something. And when you're I was always super busy with coaching and teaching. And so if I had a race coming up that was an A race, I might not have any other races before that, that I can go and put in a really hard effort. And so like, well, let's figure out a race simulation course around here that we can just go smash it for, you know, some hours and get in that kind of effort. And then rest up for a few weeks and be ready to go on race day. And it's not our first massive punch in the face. So
yeah, that really is a luxury to have different events that you can pick from to be able to do that. And not all of us have the time or the means or the circumstances to be able to do that. It's a great point. I really like the idea of building up that. In fact, that's actually what I'm doing this weekend, is building up like a race simulation for national championships. It doesn't have to be the same length necessarily. It doesn't have to be the same in any particular way. Just allow you to be able to apply the execution plan that you're going to use on race day, right? And then see how that ends up working. You mentioned there the balance side of things. You're a father of five. You also, you're a husband to your wife. You have, and what grade do you teach for school?
I teach high school English as a second language. So I work with 7th through 12th graders at our high school that are usually new to country and don't speak English. So,
and you're the track coach?
Yep, the girls' track coach and the boys' head soccer coach. So,
and busy. Does track include cross country as well for your school?
No, cross country's in the fall when soccer's going on. So I used to be the cross country coach before I became the soccer coach. And then in the spring, I just have track going on. But yeah, it's an action-packed year.
That's a ton. How do you balance it in terms of what sort of training volume do you do, and how have you arrived at that decision with all of your responsibilities?
Yeah, so right now I'm on a low-volume training plan. And we'll kind of, I would guess as we talk here, we'll get into why I've arrived at that being the best thing. And for everybody listening, they're going to be like, everything you just listed, of course, that's the best thing for you. But I think when we come from the background that I did with endurance, with track and all that, and high volume, you know, high volume was king, right? With running and once I got my core strength under control on the bike, I didn't have injury problems anymore, and I could handle high volume on the bike too. And so for a long time, for years, I did high volume type work. And then when I started using Trainer Road a few years ago, high volume, of course, we're not even going to look at low volume and mid volume. We're going to go straight to high volume because that's what we do. And now I look back and I'm like, that was a little crazy to try and do that while managing everything else in life.
What did you, let's talk about what you noticed during those times, like indicators that, hey, this is too much.
Yeah. The big thing was I could put together good blocks of training. And then, you know, I mean, you mentioned it already. We're going to be talking about bipolar disorder, right? And bipolar has these kind of big swings up and these also super low points. You got basically mania and depression, and it's kind of this ebb and flow. And you could look, if you look on my like career Trainer Road graph, you can see this where like I'd be going along fine, handling 500 TSS. All of a sudden I'd have a manic period and I knock out 3 weeks in a row at 800 TSS. And a couple, you know, I have a really close friend, Jasper, who would text me and be like, dude, are you okay? and at this point we didn't know like that I was struggling with this. He was just like, you're putting in huge training amounts. And I'm really worried about like that you're overdoing it. And he was more worried from a, like, you're going to overtrain yourself into the ground. But then I would come out of these periods and I would have times where like, I don't want to get out of bed. My arms feel like they weigh 300 pounds. My sleep is so disrupted, and complicating all of this, And like I said, you can kind of see that pattern throughout, especially 2017, 2018, 2019, where you see that pattern of like steady training that's really good, and then super training, and then like we're not going to do anything for a while. Mm. Complicating all of that was the fact that in 2015 I tested positive for Epstein-Barr, which is mono. So like obviously yesterday when Mark Cavendish won, I cried and was super happy. And I know that me saying that dates when we're interviewing, but like that was a,
sure,
that was a big deal for me as somebody who's gone through that. And like, I know how he felt, right? And I have great empathy for that, but I had had mono. And so every time I'd have one of these like super training things and then I dip, a lot of the medical community would just say, well, your mono has just like reactivated. Mm-hmm. And you just need to like, it's not a big deal and you just need to rest and then you'll be fine. But it was, the frequency of it was often, or a couple times a year where I would get going again and be totally fine. And then I would have these big crashes where I'd like, basically didn't want to do anything. And I did not to the point where it was affecting my work, but it was definitely affecting everything else. And I would, you know, I think about in 2018 when that happened, that was also the, like the weekend of Amstel Gold that Matthew Vanderpool like pulled the rabbit out of the hat. Right. And, we, mm-hmm. And I just remember like laying in bed and watching that and being like, just thinking about riding a bike makes me tired and I don't want to do this. Which is so, I love riding my bike, right?
Yeah.
It's such a, and I love exercising and to go through those periods where like, I can't even walk through my basement and look over at where all my bike stuff is because I don't want to think about it. You know, there were those big swings. We can kind of go from there, however you want.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about differentiating between the typical training cycle and that. So I'm sure a lot of cyclists that are listening to this are thinking of, yeah, so you have loading phases and deloading phases, and you feel really tired and so this is just normal. How did you differentiate or how did you come to the point where you were like, this isn't just the ebb and flow of endurance training? Because they it can be confused.
Yeah. Honestly, it was 2019. I kind of went through some more of those swings in my build up to the Matahe 100, which I'll just put a plug in. It's an amazing race. It's in the Badlands of North Dakota. It's like 11,000 feet of climbing, which
it's super hard. I've heard.
The year I did it, we had a 4-hour stretch where it was 108 degrees. But I definitely had entered a low cycle when I raced that and I kind of ground through it, because I was just like, I'm not a quitter. I'm not quitting this, but I got done with it and I did not want to ride my bike for a long time. And I basically didn't touch my bike other than here and there to ride around with my kids for quite a long time. And I still at this point was thinking, because this is what I was being told, I'm dealing with mono, right? I'm dealing with mono and the setbacks of that. And then about the previous 18 months or 12 months, I had these huge swings of productivity and creativity that would last for a month or two. And I would require like no sleep during that time. And sometimes I wouldn't even, a couple of times I just stopped eating. Because like I have all this energy, why do I need to eat or sleep? And I would go and I got a lot of really good stuff done. You know, like
thankfully, so it's easy to pat yourself on the back in that time frame too, right?
And a lot of people who struggle with bipolar, if they have substance abuse issues, it can be devastating because you can get on these manic highs and you can just get down that road and it's super destructive. And for me, it was always just about being like super, super productive. And if you see the documentary, if people watch that you mentioned, you see that I wrote like two books in like a 3-month time period. And so like before I was diagnosed, I would hear people be like, yeah, I'm taking a year off to write a book. And I'm like, why do you need to take a year off? Mm. Like I did it in 2 months, not realizing that's not normal, you know?
Yeah.
And like I, we have at our house, we have 2 miles of single track mountain bike trail. And I happened to cut all 2 miles of that last May and June during the pandemic, during lockdown, because I didn't have anything to do. And I would, you know, work out in my woods for 10, 12 hours a day, come in, get my kids to bed, and then like watch World Cup course videos on like, what do they have on their trails that would be cool to incorporate here? You know, and then we got to July and I crashed. I didn't get out of bed for 10 days. And, wow. and that, you know, my kids referenced the time when dad didn't get out of bed and he just watched YouTube all day for, you know, a week and a half. And we still didn't quite recognize in hindsight, obviously you look and you're like, yeah, dude, how are you missing this? But we didn't quite know what was going on. And we had a third huge swing last year that happened during the soccer season. And it's one of those things where like, I think things happen for a reason. And the timing of things happens for a reason. And I don't want to downplay any part of the pandemic, but I don't think if the pandemic's not, I think if the pandemic's not going on, we don't figure this out about me. Because I started to have a major crash, on my way in. It was kind of already going on. But I like physically crashed walking into school one day and I was so concerned that I had COVID and I didn't want to shut my soccer team down. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be that person that would ruin our soccer season. So I went to see our school nurse and I said, God, I don't know what's going on. My heart's racing. I haven't slept in 3 weeks, got all this stuff. My chest hurts. Do you think I have COVID? And she talked with me for like half an hour. And at the end of that, she was like, there's no way you have COVID. But you're going to leave right now and go see your doctor about mental health and depression and anxiety. And we didn't really understand the bipolar piece quite yet because bipolar is a genetic piece. So we talk about those training cycles, right? I'm not even anywhere near your question, what you asked me originally.
This is great. This is wonderful. This is great. Yeah.
But bipolar is genetic. So like when we talk about how do you know if this is just training cycle or not? Well, the first thing would be is do you have people in your family who are also bipolar? Because the doctors know that this tends to be a genetic problem. I had forgotten going in and talking to my nurse and my doctor, and maybe not forgot, I was just in such a low spot, I didn't remember, that on one side of my family, there's quite a bit of bipolar disorder. And so they start treating me, and don't be afraid. People should not be afraid to go to the doctor to talk about these things. I think there's a huge fear, especially among men in our country, to go in and start to talk with your primary care physician if you're struggling with depression, especially because we're worried about being seen as weak. We're supposed to be these caregivers for our families or our wives or whomever we're with. And we're afraid that if we admit that we're struggling, we're going to have a problem. And the reality, Jonathan, is everybody's broken. Everybody carries brokenness with them. And some of us are able to hide it better than others. But for me, it got to a point where I couldn't hide it anymore and I needed help. And so I went in and started working with, it was a new doctor I had never met. And she has now continued to work with me. And we'll talk kind of, I'm sure later, about how she helped me get back into exercising again. But she helped get me started on the path of with depression and anxiety and getting me help to get sleep. I needed sleep, right? I hadn't slept in like a month.
Yeah.
So she got me out of there. And a day or two later, my sister, who's a primary care physician out in Michigan, called me and she was pretty alarmed. And she was not alarmed that I was getting help. She was alarmed that I had not told them about our family history. And I said, what's the problem? And she said, well, the stuff we use to treat anxiety and depression can make people who are bipolar really manic. Like, send them to the moon. And she goes, so you need to call them and tell them what's going on. And I found out later in the diagnosis process that some of those drugs are like the canary in the coal mine to the psychiatrist of like, you went manic on these drugs. This checks the boxes for us. So, you know, it started to get help. But for me, that was those big swings and those, they were so out of the ordinary. I mean, I know from college what it feels like to be tired from training. You know, that's how we started this original question is what's the difference? Well, A, I have the family history piece and B, this was usually when you're in those cycles of heavy training, you still feel tired at the end of the day. You know, when you're doing the high volume, you still feel tired. And I would be in these cycles of heavy training and be going on like 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night, you know, knocking out 800 TSS weeks.
And still going.
And still going. And you know, knocking out antelope plus one and like exceeding my power numbers and having no problem and feeling like just fantastic. And Jasper, what do you mean I need to sleep and not train as much? I'm having no problems. But then the, you know, you'd come off the peak and head down to the valley, and then I couldn't even fathom riding my bike. Mm.
So, and the lows, how different were the lows? Because that's another thing where a lot of athletes, whether it's a rest week or even a post race week, that those post race blues that a lot of people talk about, you know, you can feel pretty down in the dumps when you go through those things, and even in recovery week. So was there a difference there between the lows that you were experiencing with bipolar disorder and then just lows that you would experience as an endurance athlete?
Yeah. You know, when I have kind of felt normalized and raced or come out of a heavy training period, you do feel tired. You feel, you know, those easy rides, you just look forward to them. And you're like, oh, I'm so happy I only have to ride my bike for an hour today at zone one, you know, or 45 minutes or whatever it is, you know, and you're still looking forward to things. And for me, it was always, like I said, I don't even want to see my bike. I don't want anything to do with it. I want to lay in bed. I literally feel like I can't get up and do anything. You know, I'm pretty optimistic person most of the time. And when I would get in those points, I would become very pessimistic about training or riding a bike. My thought processes were extremely negative, which if you work with a counselor, or if you work through like any kind of depression checklist, all those things are going to be checking off. And they're not necessarily things that are going to be on your list of, this is what you feel like coming out of a heavy training cycle. And so those are kind of the differences that you could be looking for. And my misunderstanding through a lot of this, I always thought people who were depressed are just people who are down in the dumps and are thinking about killing themselves. And I didn't realize till I got into counseling this spring, like all these other pieces that tie in with it. And I remember the first time going through with my counselor, we're just going through a workbook together. And the first time she put that checklist in front of me of depressive symptoms, you know, there's like 40 things on the list. And I checked off like 30 of them. Mm-hmm. And I had to like shut the book, and she's like, what's wrong? And I said, if this is what depression is, then I've struggled with this for a decade. Like mm-hmm. I've had this going on for a decade. And I just thought these were parts of life, you know, that like I would feel this way, or my arms would feel super heavy, or I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. And I don't want to do certain things, or I feel like everybody's judging me, and the rest of the year, I don't feel like, you know, all those pieces that were just out of the ordinary. But I think a lot of people, they think depression is just what I said earlier, that it's the person who's suicidal or struggling to, you know, they're a lot of people hear bipolar and they think of the homeless guy who can't keep a job because he's all over the place.
Yeah, they think of like erratic mood swings, like we're talking like 1 second to the next. Or it can even be confused many times, just a poorly controlled temperament, right?
And that's rarely what bipolar actually is.
Right.
You know, and so that's just, and I should have said this, like I'm not a doctor, right? I'm an ESL teacher. A lot of this is repeating back things that the doctors that were in the documentary talked about, and repeating back things medical professionals have told me in my experience. So like, don't anybody listen to this and be like, well, I'm bipolar because these things, like go work with a medical professional who knows what they're talking about. I'm just sharing my experiences. So hopefully they can help other people.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that intersection now, and treatment, I guess. So a lot of athletes, there's a temptation to treat the blues, so to speak. Yeah. With more, and to just give yourself more, and then that just works. Have you found that the natural cycle of loading and deloading of endurance sports, is that hard to manage with bipolar disorder, and does it further complicate it? Does it complement well? That's kind of a question that I've had with this, because I see a lot of athletes go through a cycle, and that cycle can be, you know, whether it's we're talking on within a week when you're loading and then you have a recovery day or recovery week, or you have a break between bigger training cycles. I see a lot of athletes go through these ebbs and flows, and I don't, does it trigger bipolar disorder even more? Does it allow you to manage it and apply some structure to your life? How do you view the two working together?
For me, it's really, you know, it's required a paradigm shift. And it's required a paradigm shift to something that I actually try and teach all my track athletes, but I guess I hadn't really put into practice myself. And that is, like, on day one of track practice, I tell everybody, your number one priority here is to learn how to be healthy this year and learn how to, like, manage being a person and finding some time to be healthy every day. And I don't expect you to think about this the other 22 and a half hours that you're not here. And so, for me, it's part of the reason that I've gone to the low volume plans is like last night is a great example. I had youth soccer coaching, and older soccer coaching all day going on. When I got home, I had like an hour of daylight, and that was all I had time for. And I had, grassy ridge on my program. Okay. And I knew, which is 30-30s basically. Right. Mm-hmm. And I know that on my single track on our land, I have a great loop for 30-30s just over and over. And so I went out for an hour and knocked out that. And in the past, if I would have been on a high volume plan on a busy day like yesterday and gotten home and saw an hour and a half or 2 hour workout, I would have skipped it. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I would have been disappointed that I didn't do it. And it was coming off of a day off. So I would have been disappointed now that I'm 2 days off. And then the snowball kind of starts rolling. Mm-hmm. And then I might try and make up for it later. And it's been much more about, I got to get in some exercise each day that I can. 6 days a week, let's try and exercise. 1 day a week, we're going to for sure take a day off. And we're not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. But we're going to use the low volume plan, and make sure that when we do work out, it's in a way that allows me the next day to also work out. Mm-hmm. And that's been huge as well, as this idea that like whatever I'm doing today needs to allow me to recover, so tomorrow I can also do what I need to do.
That's a great takeaway, that we don't have to push ourselves up against the stops every day. Like we can get addicted to that and think that. There's also, it's a bit of a myth, really. There was a study that was done, and I'll find the link to this, but it was looking at strength training, and it looked at the last rep myth or the last two rep myths. So, like, basically, you don't reach productivity until you do the last two reps, because that's where you're actually, and it's super logical, very much bro science, because it's like, yeah, that makes sense. I don't get to the point where I'm stretching my capabilities until the final part. So those last two are really the only productive ones. So I need to get there. But that's actually proven to not be true. I believe that the measure was hypertrophy that they were looking at in this case, but I could be wrong. The point is, we don't just, training isn't just productive when it pushes us all the way down to our absolute limits. It's productive for many other reasons and long before that as well. That's a great takeaway. And that allows more consistency, which allows you to be able to feel like you're maintaining balance better. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Well, and again, like with my life everywhere else, right? It was really hard to get 7 or 8 hours of sleep a night and do a high volume plan. And yeah, my body could handle it, and I could bang out those 500 TSS weeks, week after week, and not have a problem. But I wasn't getting enough sleep. And there's a couple things that, like, lack of sleep, huge trigger. If you stack up too many days in a row of not enough sleep, that's a huge trigger for either a manic or a depressive phase. And then the other thing that's kind of become my mantra is that activity is the enemy of depression. Mm-hmm. And so, like, so if you're having a day where, and this is something that my counselor has worked with me a lot on, if you're having the day where you don't even want to get out of bed, like figure out a couple things you can get out of bed and go do. Like, even if it's, I'm going to go get out of bed and wash half the dishes and that's all I can do, but I'm going to get out and do something, you know? And there were so many times that we, in hindsight, we'd look at in the past, okay, I'd hit these big depressive lows and I would just say, I'm not going to ride my bike at all. I'm just, you know, and in really, we were pouring gas on the fire at that point, because you got this smoldering depression problem and you're now not going to be active for a month while you're sad about that you're depressed. And so for me, it's been much more since being diagnosed in December about, we got to get that activity in every day, even if it's minimal. And real quick, like, I think there's some people that get in this hole and they don't see how they can ever start exercising again. And I remember in October when I'm sitting in the doctor's office for the first time and I'm just drained, and I can feel my glands from years of no sleep and all this manic behavior and just, you know, pushing my system so hard, my glands are just taxed. And I remember sitting there and telling my doctor, I don't think I'm ever going to exercise again because I don't have any energy. And she just said, we will get you exercising again. And she started off from October to December, I was walking 10 to 15 minutes a day. That was my exercise.
Going from 60 to 90 miles a week of running, going from high volume training on a bike.
Yeah. And she said, I need you to forget that you were ever a college runner and that you ever raced your bike. She goes, you need to, you cannot think about that right now because that's not where you are. That's a different person.
Yeah. And you can't compare yourself to your circumstances have entirely changed. Your body is entirely changed. And not even to mention the fact that maybe that wasn't the best approach that you did before.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then there were pieces too, like the first drugs they put me on to treat this made me gain like 23 pounds over 3 weeks time, you know? And when you're 150 pounds and you gain that much, you know, weight, that's a huge percentage of your body that you just increased. So you're having to deal with that too. And it just took time. And then we got to January and she put me on a beginner couch to 5K, like run walk plan. And it was like, there was part of me that was like, this is humiliating. Like,
yeah, that had to have hurt your pride, right?
Yes. And at the same time, like, it was literally all I could do physically was like, okay, we're going to run for 30 seconds five times today and walk for 3 minutes five times today. Just getting to the point where eventually in February and March, she was like, okay, you can start to ride the trainer, but you can ride for 10 minutes today. And you cannot let your heart rate go above this. And so if you look through my like training, like calendar, it's all these rides called the reboot ride. And it would be like, you know, 15 minutes this week. And then the next week I got to do, you know, maybe 20 or 25 minutes. And we just slowly rebuilt things until May. I was able to start some structured training again and have felt really great doing that.
Yeah. And taking it in stride, doing a different approach than what you once did.
Yeah. And then the other big change was the paradigm of like, what is racing going to look like for me now? And instead of like, obviously I loved racing gravel. I would love to get my teeth more into events like the Matahe 100, but there's a couple of things that don't go in my favor right now. They require quite a bit of training. I can't do them without like this laser focus. And so for now, I'm racing like hour-long XCO races, and I'm racing like in a division that matches my technical abilities, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it because it's what I can do, and I can recover from it. And I realized after the first one, I'm like, you know what? Like that kind of just felt like a really hard workout. And the next day, I got out of bed and I'm like, oh, I'm not shattered. Like I raced 5 miles or 5 hours of gravel yesterday. Like I feel pretty good and we can kind of get back to work and I can squat down and pick my kids up if I need to. So there's been, you know, as I've kind of shifted paradigms, it's been really positive, but that's what I would encourage people that are struggling with this kind of thing is you've got to look what success means. Like what does success mean now? Because it probably can't be some of the things it used to be, but it doesn't mean that you can't have any success. It's just, you have to redefine it and you got to find what's going to be successful for you. And like right now, my goals are that I get 7 or 8 hours of sleep a night, that I exercise 6 days a week, and that when I do get to race, that I enjoy it. And
yeah,
you know, it's a long ways from being this like super serious gravel and guy transitioning into mountain bike a couple of years ago, but it's what I need to do now so that I'm like consistently being there, not only for myself, but for my family and my kids, and not being a stranger every day because I am too wiped out from what I did, or because I've pushed myself into this manic phase or this depressive phase by some of my other activities. And obviously treatment has a huge part to do with that too, whether it's medicine or counseling. But it all works together. None of these things, you know, are individual. You can't just like go on whatever drug they need to put you on for this and everything's good, or you can't just go to counseling, or you can't just exercise. They kind of all work in tandem for me. So
it's never just one thing. In our minds, no. We want to find just one thing, but it never really is, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a great example, John, of managing, you know, you said it really well. Another way to say it is managing, like, pride is such a complicated thing to manage for an athlete, because we should take pride in the effort of what we're putting forward, and we should take pride in the judicious choices that we put into place, and we should take pride in making the right decisions. But many times we get caught up in putting pride in the outcome, right? And that's really where it lies. And when that happens, it can push us, because then we start pulling on levers that we shouldn't really be pulling in that way, and that we can't control, but we assume that we can, and it can cause a lot. So you've through this process of the diagnosis and of beginning your steps of managing this, I feel like you've set a really good blueprint for all athletes, regardless of their current situation, to be able to look at their performance objectively, be able to take pride in their effort, and then be able to move forward in a spot that's healthy for them. So
for sure.
That's awesome. And your track students, or I should say track pupils, are really lucky to have you. So,
well, thanks. We talked a lot this spring with some of them about kind of this same idea. Because as we got into our postseason, and you know, maybe somebody had a poor race, I think sometimes, like you said, we hang our identity so much on the race result, whether it's track or soccer or bike racing or whatever, we hang our identity on that result. And I told them, I'm like, this doesn't change the last 11 weeks. Like, the last 11 weeks of training and developing in these healthy habits and all the stuff you did in the weight room and all the things you did, getting to know each other, like, a bad performance or even a performance that doesn't go how you want it to, that doesn't change all the work. You're literally a different person than you were 11 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And let's take all the good stuff. And you know, we don't get to take the good only the good in life, or only it all comes together. And so if we're taking the good and the bad together, we got to look at, you know, the majority of this was progress, and how do we move forward with that?
Yeah. Yeah, great advice, John. So you mentioned that you're racing XCO now. Are there any specific events or anything else that you're looking forward to and excited for?
Yeah, once our youth soccer program ends on July 1st, probably already before the time people will hear this, but then my summer opens up a little bit, and starting in late July, I've got 5 or 6 races over a handful of weeks' time that I'll be doing, and I'm just excited to be healthy and racing, like I said, and the chance to connect with a lot of friends that I haven't gotten to see because of the pandemic and because of health reasons for quite a while. And so that's exciting. But yeah, nothing, there's no race coming up that I'm like, this is the thing. They're all just a lot of local or semi-local races that I'll get to see friends at and have fun and let her rip for a little bit. So
yeah, that's what I love about cross country Olympic and those shorter events like that. It's iterative. You get to do it multiple times, and yeah, I absolutely love it. John, this has been a fantastic episode. If people want to get in touch with you, like you mentioned, you're not a doctor. But at the same time, I'm sure that, somebody may have questions, whether it's about your training or whether it is about bipolar disorder or anything else. How can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, probably the easiest way for people is to find me on Instagram, and you can just search John Peter, or you can my label is JP's Gravel Adventures.
Nice.
But even though it's a lot more like mountain biking and playing with my kid adventures, but yeah, you can find me there. And then if you just want to hear more about the kind of the depth of my story, you can check out the documentary on YouTube. It's called We Are From Pelican. It's a 7-episode documentary following our soccer team through this season. So, and it's got a lot of twists and turns to it. So.
Fantastic kids in that program too. It's great. So John, I really appreciate you doing this. I hope you have an absolute blast at your XC races this year. And that you get a ton out of your training and just have a blast with it. So I appreciate you doing this. And for everybody listening, if you want to be on the Successful Athletes podcast, you can submit your story. I'd love to hear from you. However, TrainerRoads helped you manage anything, any form of success that you've found in your life, you can do so at trainerroad.com/SAP. I read through them every week. So go ahead and submit them. There's zero judgment. It's an awesome place for anybody to be able to share their story. So looking forward to hearing from you, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks, everybody.